Hi, everybody. This is Patty Bechtold, and I'm really pleased today to be having a conversation with Charlotte Raines Dixon, who has a new book out. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, Patty. Thank you so much for having me here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Let's just jump in and tell us about anything you want us to know about you and about your book right off the bat.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm a writer. First and foremost, I'm a writer. I am now proud that I can call myself an author. I've sort of been in this transition from being a writer to an author with a published book. My novel, Imogene's Bad Behavior, was just released on Tuesday, February 12th, and I'm very excited about it. It's been a lifelong dream of mine, literally since I was a small child, to become a novelist. And you might be able to call me a late bloomer because I'm not one of those people who got published and had their dreams come true in their 30s or even their 40s, to be honest. And the longer that you have to wait for something, maybe the better it is. I don't know. I'm just really excited about this. I've been a writer for my entire adult life in one way or another. I've done freelance writing. I've done writing for the web. I actually teach writing. I live in Portland, Oregon, but I teach writing in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, at Middle Tennessee State University in a distance writing program there, and put in a plug for Nashville. I love going to Nashville. It's a wonderful town, and I'm blessed to have that job. I also coach and teach writers privately, and I have a blog, charlotteraincedixon.com, where I write a lot about writing and about getting inspired. Actually, I think I write more about getting inspired and sort of spirituality and, you know, broadly creativity and the underpinnings of writing, because I have a strong belief that, you know, you can be the most talented writer in the world, but if you can't get yourself to the computer or to the spiral pad with your pen in hand, if you can't get yourself to start putting words on the page, nobody's ever going to see your brilliance. So I really think I write more about that and the creative aspect than anything else, although I do write about writing. So that's kind of me at this moment in a nutshell.
Yeah, and I think that's how I initially stumbled upon you, was sort of the content of your writing on your blog is so kind of adaptable to where a lot of us are in terms of moving forward with our creativity or deepening sort of our practices. And I think there's a universality to what you write on your blog.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to hear that. And I do, I mean, you know, one of the things that I always say as a writing teacher, and that's sort of a quote-unquote rule of writing, is that the universal is in the specific, or the universal is in the details. And so, you know, I tell people to put details in their writing, and so thus I write about writing, and I try to expand it out to creativity, but I think a lot of us have read The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron.
Right.
You know, it's one of these seminal books on creativity, and she kind of talks about that. It's like, you know, writing bears on doing art, and doing art bears on being a fiber artist or doing knitting. I'm a knitter. If you want to write a musical, I mean, I think sometimes people think that, if I go and get interested in any other kind of art besides my writing, or perhaps you're an artist and you suddenly feel the urge to write, you know, vice versa. You're like, oh, no, but I can't do that because it'll take away from my true calling. And I think any kind of creativity, the more we open to the flow, whether it's the spiritual flow or the creative flow, and I happen to think that they're one and the same. I don't think they can really be separated very easily. But, you know, the more you open to the flow, the more you get that circulation going, the more you're able to do whatever your passion is, whether you're a healer or a painter. I think I'm a closet painter. I keep going back to that painting. I should pay attention to that.
Well, you know, there's definitely a sense of multipotentiality in you and in what you write about. And I think there's a sense of joyfulness in that too that's really appealing.
Thank you.
I love your writing, and I'm really happy that I had a chance to read your book. I want to circle back to something you said. I think it's really interesting. You said, you know, I've been a writer for a long time, and now I'm an author. And I got the feeling it was almost a sense of walking through a threshold passage for you in a way. I don't know if that sounds right or not, but like turning a corner or entering a new phase in your life.
It is. I actually have a close friend who is a mystery writer in Texas, and he's a big, long, tall Texan, and he talks with the drawl, and he wears cowboy hats and cowboy boots, and he was a writer, but like a PR person for many, many years, and now he's enjoying a second career as an author. He's retired, and he is writing award-winning mysteries, which is really exciting. And he and I were having either an email exchange or a Facebook exchange, and I said, Ravis, you are my inspiration for taking this step. And it really does feel like that because, you know, as a writer, and it's not that one is lesser than the other because, you know, it's just not. It's just a different kind of way of thinking about myself. And thinking about how I want to spend my time, too. And one of my goals in life is to spend more time being an author and authoring books than I do some of the teaching stuff. I love being a teacher. Don't get me wrong. God, I learned so much from teaching and interacting with students and interacting with people on the Internet, which I guess I've never thought of this before, but that's kind of a form of teaching too. I mean, of course, it was in my blog, but I was just thinking of like social media and, you know. But I feel like it's my time. Part of stepping into that new role as author is to really look at my time. And I know, you know, that's the kind of thing that you write about and think about. We were talking about balance a little bit earlier and trying to find the right balance of how much time do I put to my passion and how much time do I put to the things that pay me and how much time do I put to, you know, this over here. So it really does feel like, you know, I like that idea. I see myself as like taking the step, you know, the threshold is such a great word. And I think that just defines it so clearly because it is. And it's just, in every sense of the word, step in a different direction.
Yeah. I can just hear the depth of that for you in walking into that new place and really claiming it. It sounds like. And
well, yeah, And go ahead.
Well, what's interesting to me, you know, because you talked a little about what you do, you know, you're a writer and now you're an author, you're a writing teacher, you're a writing coach, you know, you live in Portland, and there are some obvious similarities there between you and the character that you just created in this book, who's a pretty interesting character. And and I wondered if those, you know, that, you know, it's interesting to sort of think about that concept you're talking about, that you stepped into this new threshold and Emma Jean was already there, but also sort of wondering about how she could sustain it. And I wonder if you could talk maybe about the differences and the similarities and how that came up in the writing and what that meant for you.
I would love to. There are a lot of similarities. Surface similarities. That's one of the things when the book came out, we're talking about, you know, claiming myself as an author, and all of a sudden hear this book that is my heart's project. It's like having a baby is out there, and people are judging it. It's like, you know. And one of the things that I've worried about and thought about is, God, are people going to think that I'm just like Emma Jean? I mean, people who don't know me, for the many people listening to this who haven't read the book yet, you know, she's brash and she is, she says whatever she damn well wants to in the moment, and somebody who read the book described her as, she said she just wanted to take her and shake her, but at the same time she knew that, and she was saying, I think I could relate to that.
Well,
she wanted
you know,
to take her and shake her. Go ahead.
Yeah. What's interesting is that I noticed that she's exasperated by a lot of things, and yet people are also kind of exasperated with her, especially in the early
yes.
part of the book, you know?
Yes,
she's got a certain level of sort of fame and status, and yet she doesn't seem very happy. She's pretty exasperated.
No.
And she goes on a campaign to be kinder. So she's
yes.
aware. She's aware that she's got these narcissistic kind of tendencies, but she doesn't quite know how to, you know, what to do with that. You know what I'm saying? That's what it seemed like to me.
Right. Definitely.
And I love that, you know, because it's like she does have like that thing about wanting to shape her. There's something so rich in a character like that because, my God, we're all like that sometimes, you know? We all
right.
have these things that are not the most appealing about ourselves, and we don't really
right.
want people to know about them, you know? We kind of try to hide that, and she's kind of out there with that.
You know, I think that's a really good way of describing her, and I feel like she's in some ways my alter ego. Like when you're just exasperated, I love that word that describes her so well. When you're just mm-hmm. exasperated with somebody and you're trying so hard to be nice about it on the surface, and you know, Imogene just gets exasperated. I mean, she's sort of all of us times 100.
Uh-huh.
And actually, when I was marketing the book, when I was trying to sell the book, over and over and over again, I heard that she was. You know, agents were kind of afraid of her because they felt like she was unrelatable. That was, I don't even think that's a real word, but that's the publishing world's word. And they said, oh, she's unrelatable. We don't think we can sell that. I love her, but, you know, I just don't know. I worry about it because I think she's unrelatable. And it's funny because people who have read it have said in some ways they do relate to it in that sense of, she's sort of the person that always has the thing to say that you wish you could say, or, you know, somebody's
right.
annoying her and she just slaps them in the face. She doesn't do that, but, you know, metaphorically slaps them. So,
right.
So, yeah.
He's,
and I'm
yeah.
not, I like to think that I'm not like that in terms of the similarities. Yes, there are some similarities between us, but I sure hope that's not one of them.
Oh, I don't think that's you, but I think it's fascinating that you said, you know, she's kind of like my alter ego, you know. There is, you know, all those different parts of us, and I think you did a great job pulling that out. Something that is sort of difficult, I imagine, to write. I mean, I don't know that. I don't want to make that assumption, though. But
you know, I'll tell you, I sort of had the idea for the book, and Imogene blasted on to the page, and I actually had to tone her voice down. I've never had a character come alive so fully. Her voice, it was like, you know, taking dictation. She just sort of started writing the book. I wish that would happen again. It's not happening with the book I'm working on at the moment. I mean, the book's flowing, but it's just the voice. You know, I mean, Imogene has a very distinct voice. And
she does.
So... But I did have to kind of work to tone it down a little bit, I will say. So.
It almost sounds like she kind of possessed you, you know?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, and then the interesting thing is I wanted to bring this up. You were talking about the similarities and, you know, how that bore on writing the book. The other interesting thing that has happened is that some of the things that happened in the book that I made up have sort of since come into my life, which is really weird.
Wow.
You know, there's some things that I don't want to come into my life. I keep telling the universe, don't bring that part into my life. But there's a character in the book named Ava, she's my favorite character in the whole book. She's a young whippersnapper of a young girl, and I don't know, I think she's 12 or 13, and There's a friend of mine who lives in New Mexico whose daughter has started emailing me and who was, on a call that I did the other night. I was like, oh, my God, that's Ava. She is Ava. She's very precocious. Ava in the book wants to become a writer, and this young girl wants to become a writer, and she asks me questions about, her English paper that she's working on, and the same thing happens in the book. And so it's really funny. And then there's another character who had sort of a similar thing happen, and every once in a while I just stop and think, wow, that's wild. It's like these characters existed in my mind, and then I brought them into fruition or something. I don't know. That's really mysterious.
Yeah. Well, it almost sounds like you tapped into something that you didn't even know you were tapping into, something that was already there, you know?
I love that idea. I love that idea. I mean, I think that's really how the universe does work, and we're all tapped into it, but we just don't know it. So that is really cool.
Well, what's that like? I mean, to have parts of the book showing up in your life, characters from the book showing up in your life. It sounds like it's compelling, but it's also a little bit scary.
It's a little bit scary. It makes me laugh. I mean, it takes me a while to realize it, and then all of a sudden I'll realize, oh wow, that's Ava. It is a little bit scary, but you know, just what the exchange that we just had. I mean, when you think about it, that's so profound. It's like I feel like I tapped into something, and it was there all the time, and it just needed to be brought in up into the world. And you know, that feels like a real spiritual thing to always remember. You know, it's like, okay, there really are all these possible futures that you could tap into.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
it sounds like
when you step back and you sort of center yourself in that, there's a real pleasure and satisfaction in that, you know?
Yes.
Be part of it.
Yes.
You know, something about Emma Jean that I also noticed that I think probably is a lot like you. And I don't know this for sure. I don't know you really well. We've known each other sort of as blogging friends for a little while. But in spite of her sort of, what did they call it? Her
unrelatable.
Her unrelatableness, you know, and her sort of like kind of me, you know. Like I had a friend who used to say, okay, now that we've talked about me, let's talk about me. You know, she was kidding, but sort of that where the world...
Sort of kidding.
Really, yeah, sort of kidding. We can all go there.
Yeah.
Right? Where the world kind of revolves around her. You know, she has this other thing, though. She has this really interesting innocence that as the book wore on, I started to notice it even more. And maybe it is a little bit of a naive innocence, but I kind of experience you as being having a wise innocence and an openness to the world and sort of trust and faith that you know life is good. And I don't know if that part of you came into Emma Jean, if that's something that you felt like happened.
I'm thinking about that. That's a really good question. It took me a minute to think about it. I think Emma Jean, well, I think the part of her that saves her, I hope, I know that she, you know, can be exasperating and maybe at times it's hard to relate to her, whatever. But I do think that innocence, somebody said that she had a deeply wounded soul. And I think that's where she becomes every woman, because all of us growing up in this world, we become, I think all of us have a deeply wounded soul. And, you know, you have two choices. You can either close down to the world or try to stay open to it and, you know, figure, well, my heart's already been broken, so let's see what else can happen, you know. So, I think that I hope that I try to be joyful. And I was just talking with a friend this morning. It's like, wow, you know, we're pretty lucky. We're pretty lucky. And I try to really be aware of that, and that gratitude and that, you know, that sense of joy. And I love that you think I'm a wise, that I have a wise innocence about me, and you know, strive to be open. That's one of the things I'm working on this year, is, you know, keeping the channels open and keeping the flow going. So nice to hear that.
Well, you know, I love sort of stories and archetypes, and I know you love that stuff too. And there's you know, what you're saying is so true, that we all have, you know, we start out trusting and innocent and hopeful, and then we all have some sort of a fall and or a wound, and the sort of danger is kind of not being able to find our way back to a wiser form of innocence, and staying kind of in that victim place, you know, feeling kind of
right. Orphaned. Exactly.
And so I think maybe that's what I was picking up in her, now that I think about it more. And maybe that's what Riley saw in her, you know, that underneath the sort of, you know, loudmouth kind of thing, that there
right.
was something trusting and real and true and sweet in her.
Well, and I think that at the beginning of the book, she is quite distant from her true self. And the part of her journey, she goes on a spiritual journey, but she also goes on a personal journey. Again, one and the same. And I think she ends up at a very different place at the end of the book. At least that's how I saw it. She's much more
right.
authentic. She's much more real. She's not trying to have this image. You know, throughout the beginning of the book, every time she sees a fan, quote unquote, which is what she calls her readers, which gives you a little bit of an idea of, you know, her attitude about the world. You know, she lapses into her, oh, darling, I'm so happy to see you and thank you so very much, doll. You know, sort of this whole act that she puts on that I think she kind of has learned to believe over the years. And through the conflicts and tensions that happened to her over the course of the book, I think she's really come into herself much more so by the end of it.
Yeah, and that's the sense that I got, that he saw in her what she was becoming rather
her
than
true self.
I love that.
Nobody's ever said that before. That is fabulous. That's perfect. I love these conversations because stuff like this comes out, you know. It's really cool.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, like you said, it was kind of a hard journey for her to get there. I mean, you know, speaking of, you know, that story arc of the hero's journey, and we talked about that before, and we both really liked that sort of creatively and psychologically. And so, you know, there's that dark night of the soul. There's that, you know, she's got a big one in the book, you know, the letting the turning it over. And you know, the thing about that that's always so fascinating to me is that in stories and in life, it's you know, it's usually a pretty hopeless place, but it is the giving up and the turning over and the letting go that to bring people back to hope. It's a weird paradoxical thing. And so
it is.
You wrote about that really well, and I wondered if you wrote about that so well because you really knew about that. You really understood that at a deep level. I was curious about that.
I have always been attracted to the hero's journey, both as a paradigm for storytelling and as a paradigm for personal growth. And I think that I have read about it and studied it a lot and enough through the years that it's hardwired into me. And, you know, in some ways, I did not purposely say, okay, you know, when Imogene gets the call to adventure, you know, here's her ordinary world, that's how they always start, and here's the call to adventure. The call to adventure is when she meets Riley, of course. I mean, I didn't set out to say, oh, I've got to make this happen, you know, at every step along the way, but I think it does follow that pretty closely, and it follows that because I am just so aware of that. I mean, I watch movies and I'm like, oh, there's the call to adventure. There's the, you know, there's the gatekeeper. There's the, you know, it's just part of me. It's part of the way I approach life, I think. And I will
sounds like
say,
it's your language, kind of. It's part of your
it
language.
It is. It is. Yeah. Yes. Yes. And I will say that I, from personal experience, repeatedly have had the experience of, you know, going through a dark night of the soul, even if it's a mini, like M-I-N-I, a small dark night
right,
of the soul.
Right.
The way out is through, first of all, but then the way out is just to give it all up, to let go, as you were saying. And that is the hardest thing to do, at least for me. You know, it. I don't know why it is, but just we think we have control. We think we know, you know, I've got an appointment book full of appointments tomorrow, and I think I know that I'm going to get up and go boom, boom, boom through these appointments, but I don't know that. You know, maybe, who knows what might happen. They might all cancel. I mean, you know, you just don't know. We think we have this sense of control, and we strive to hang on to it as hard as we possibly can, when truly the other way, just being willing to let go and see what happens, is the path to happiness and to authentic living and to all of that. I did, you know, there is the dark night of the soul in Imogene, and she, things sort of pile up on her and pile up on her and pile up on her, and there is a scene where, you know, very consciously had that scene where she just, you know, gave it all up, and I think she even says that, you know, said, okay, this, I can't do it anymore, I'm just going to let it all out and let it go, and that's when things start changing and improving. So that was a very conscious creation because of my experience with that being
right.
So
helpful. I thought so. That was really a really pivotal point in the book. And,
yes, definitely.
You did it really well,
thank you.
You know, something you just said really strikes me, that in real life, you know, the dark night of the souls are kind of happening again and again. I mean, it's that kind of thing where there's a lot of insight in that, where it's a day-to-day thing where we give up and then renew, you know, because that's sort of the process where we say, well, I don't really know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Right.
But it's kind of living in that place between certainty and uncertainty. It's hard to do, but it's sort of where, you know, I don't know, where we find, I don't want to call it peace, but sort of the richness of life. It's not exactly peaceful, but I think you're...
No, but it's like you're, you know, when I was listening to you talk, the words that popped in were creative cycle. It's part of the creative cycle, too. I mean, I think we forget that. I mean, I think people feel like, oh, when you're creative, you've got to be creative every single day, full out. And no, the creative, there is a cycle to creativity, just like there's a cycle to life and death and all of this stuff. And it is a process of letting go and, you know, putting words on the page and then letting them go. And, you know, you can't go full out every single minute with it. You can't constantly be painting or constantly be putting words on the page. You dry up. And so that's what was really striking me when you were talking. I kept thinking, creative cycle.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a wisdom there to pay attention to that.
Definitely.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things we've talked about before, or I don't know, it's like I feel like I've talked to you and we've never really talked before.
I know.
I love
that.
That's
a good way. I do too.
Because we've had this sort of, I guess it's sort of like a correspondence through our blogs.
Yeah, like commenting on each other's blogs. And
yeah, and getting to know each other that way. In that wisdom that you're talking about, there's a, you know, it reminds me of something I like to say, that we all have this quiet knowing deep within us that's always been there. And I think you know, we've kind of talked about this, how there's so much advice these days, and there's so much possibility of you can do this and you can do that. And Emma Jean goes on, she's trying this, she's trying angels, and she's trying, you know, Buddhism, and she's
she tries everything.
Crystals. Yeah, yeah. And so I'm really fascinated by, I mean, that's something that comes up with a lot of my clients too, is to really be able to hear that quiet knowing that's always present for them. And do you think that that's a point that Emma Jean finally came to? And also, how does that show up for you in your life?
I think that that is a point that she finally comes to, and I think she comes to it because she stops resisting. I mean, I think part of it, I mean, that's just what popped into my head. She, in the book, she resists and she tries every single thing, and she resists having anything to do with Jesus or Christianity or the Bible, and I'm not espousing any kind of religious point of view in the book, and I'm fairly, you know, I have my own spiritual belief and my own spiritual community, but I don't believe in pushing it on people, and it's very eclectic and very, you know, a lot of different wisdom paths have a lot of truth in them, so I don't want to make it sound like I'm espousing any one particular point of view, but the one thing that she really kind of refused to consider was traditional Christianity or Christianity of any kind, even non-traditional Christianity, and she resisted and resisted and resisted that, and I think that's ultimately what she finds comfort in. And again, I just don't want people to think that I'm trying to espouse that, because I'm not at all. And I do think there is so much to, I feel like she removed all the layers. I mean, all the dark night of the soul that she had to go through. She was peeling away layers and peeling away layers and peeling away layers, and finally she could get to that quiet voice that rests within. I mean, she had so many layers of gunk and false imagery and false personas on top of her that she couldn't even hear that voice anymore. It's kind of how I see it. And I'll tell you, I am a huge believer in listening to that voice in my own life, and I do meditate and I do pray, but the way that I find that voice for me personally is by writing in my journal or doing morning pages, whatever you want to call them. Soul writing is one word for it. And I try to do it every morning. And, you know, I had a run of about a month where every morning I was just accessing this rich, deep vein of stuff. And it's so exciting. And you and I talked about this too. I think we talked about this, the process writing, and you know, you said how so much of your blog posts and so much of your writing comes out of doing this kind of journaling, process writing, whatever, just mad crazy writing on the page, you know, talking to a voice, talking to God if you want to, talking to the goddess or you know, whomever, and just letting it all flow out on the page. And to me, You know, you can ask that quiet voice within, you know, what do I need to see today? What do I need to work on? What do I need to, you know, what am I not seeing? I mean, there's so many different ways you can access it. And, you know, I often think this is sacrilegious, but I think my best meditation is on the page. I mean, I don't even know if you can really call that meditation, but to me, that's my spiritual time. That's my sacred time when I'm just like spewing it out on the page. And it's funny because this morning I had a fairly unsatisfying time writing, and that happens sometimes. You know, you've just got to say, well, that was today, and tomorrow it'll be deeply satisfying again. So that to me is how I uncover my voice.
Wow. That's a really great sort of journey through, you know, getting there and keeping it alive. I mean, I heard, you know, it's a process of peeling away. You talked about that for Emma Jean. I think that's true for lots of us, peeling away layer after layer.
I think
layer
so, too.
Persona after persona. And then looking at what is it that we just keep stumbling upon and resisting and and giving up, stopping resisting is that point, that place where we really can finally hear the quiet knowing that's always been present. And we keep it alive by engaging with it. You know, you do
yes.
it by pouring it out onto the page, and it sounds a lot like active imagination, you know, where you're that maybe you dial
That's it, exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
It is active imagination. And when I used to do active imagination, I would get into this whole thing where I'd be like, you know, voice or God, me. And, where it had to be like question and answer, you know, like
yeah.
we were doing a Q&A, and I got a little bit too routine there. It didn't quite work for me. But that's basically exactly what I'm talking about, you know, asking
yeah.
a lot of questions and just seeing what comes up.
Right. You know, that's a experience that I've had too with it, where if I get into too many questions and don't let the flow or the dialogue just come naturally, then I'm too much in my head about it. Somebody really wise, actually he was a Jungian, said, you know, when we're always asking questions, it's really more of a cognitive process than a soul process.
Oh, interesting.
You know? Yeah,
that's really interesting.
Put us into that analytical thing, and which is good, you know, we need to figure things out sometimes. We need to...
Yes, no, that's true. I think it's really important to go back and forth, though. You know, yeah, you need to figure things out, but you want to get back into your heart. I mean, so many of us tend to be in our heads all the time, you know, and I think it's really important to try to dive down into the heart and the soul and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, this has been, I think this is probably the perfect place to bring our conversation to a close.
Okay.
Because I don't know. It just feels right, doesn't it?
I think it feels right, too. No, that's perfect. I know. We've been going and going, so.
I know, and we could go and go.
We could, yes.
So what do you want to tell people about how they can get the book and where they can find your blog and your site?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, my site is my name, Charlotte Rains Dixon, and it's R-A-I-N-S, just like the weather. That's my maiden name. I grew up saying that. And D-I-X-O-N, CharlotteRainsDixon.com. You can Google it, or Google Imogene's Bad Behavior. It should come up. You can buy the book, and it's Imogene, two words, E-M-M-A, and then J-E-A-N. Sometimes people think I'm saying Imogene as in I-M-O-G-E-N-E. Imogene's Bad Behavior, it's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Powell's online. And you can get an ebook or a regular trade paperback. And thank you so much for this conversation, Patty. This has just been a delight. It's just been wonderful to talk with you.
Well, thank you. I feel the same way, and it's been a really rich experience. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to stop our recording, and then I'll come back. We'll say a little goodbye to each other. And
okay, great. Okay.
Yeah, and to everybody who's listening, thank you so much for tuning into this. And I hope to be having more of these conversations with other people that I've met online, because I think it's a really fun thing to do. So thanks a lot, Charlotte.
Thank you.